You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the ABA Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. I'm here in my individual capacity as always, and we appreciate you listening. We're continuing our series on the national security issues we're facing with the rapid development of AI. We're also going to talk about battery technology, the implications of quantum computing, and changes in the kinetic aspects of conflict. Part of this discussion includes an acknowledgement of how our energy needs are going to change drastically in the coming decade, something I think we're all half ignoring at this point. Now, many of our advanced weapon systems, our automobiles, our communications devices, they all require batteries. But how much storage and energy can batteries really hold? What are sort of the limits of their utility? And what are the necessary ingredients for batteries? Where are those ingredients found? Where are the raw ingredients processed so that they can be used in batteries? And can batteries ever serve as redundant energy sources for data centers or power plants? And do batteries even contribute to the grid? Can batteries even really be recharged or recycled? If they can, what are the consequences, first and second order? And when batteries have reached their end of useful life, where do they go and what are the consequences? Here to discuss this energy topic is Mark Mills. Mark is the founder and executive director of the National Center for Energy Analytics. He's a distinguished fellow at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, and he's a contributing editor to City Journal. He's a faculty fellow at Northwestern University School of Engineering and co-founding partner of Montrose Lane. He has these videos, PragerU videos, which have been viewed over 10 million times. And he's the author of several books, one of which recently is The Cloud Revolution, How the Convergence of New Technologies Will Unleash the Next Economic Boom and the Roaring 2020s. That sounds very optimistic. I'm going to have him explain that. And many people have commented about this energy book and said that this is actually one of the only books that actually explains energy. I can tell you, I have talked to people familiar with Mark, and they said, we need to talk. So Mark, thanks so much. I really am glad that you came in tonight.
Great to join you, and thank you for that long and overgenerous introduction.
We do that. We do that. We're very generous here.
It's a skill. It's good.
It is. Let's talk batteries. We think we know what they are. I've seen them. You know, they're sort of cylindrical.
They can be flat. They can be round. They can be any shape you like.
Yeah, I don't like that. I want to know what the shape is. But why don't you give us a technical primer?
Electricity is hard to store. It's an important commodity in our modern society. Most people remember their grade school history, Thomas Edison, the development of electrification over the last century and a half. But most of civilization, the idea of electricity was a natural phenomenon, lightning. Benjamin Franklin knew what it was. And scientists understood it for a long time. Electric eels, a lot of animals can produce small amounts of electricity. Electrochemical reactions have been familiar to scientists and philosophers for centuries. But making electricity the way we make it today is utterly unique in human history. It transforms society. It's a magical thing. And that's why all the things that we take for granted in everyday life, not just turning lights on, but electricity lets you do things that were impossible before, like make an air conditioner or make a laser that can do eye surgery or a laser that can cut metal and weld things. That's enabled by this unique form of energy that we manufacture. So electricity is not a primary energy source. The point of this is we make it. We manufacture it. To say it's profound is sort of understates it, but we take it for granted. It was viewed by the largest engineering society in America as the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. And they and the National Academy of Sciences did a survey of scientists and engineers in Y2K. What was the most important invention of the 20th century? But what won overwhelmingly was the electric grid, electricity, electrification. Most of everything else derived from that. So long way of saying, like, duh, it's important, right? It's a massive industry, trillions of dollars of capital invested. It is a massive network, that tens of thousands, 100,000 miles of wire, which means it has security implications, protecting it. It has national security implications for operating it reliably. You have to have all of our weapon systems depend increasingly on electrified things. But how do you store something so important? The physics of storing electricity are profoundly annoying and difficult. It's just storing electrons or electric charge. So it's kind of like storing an idea in a way. It's just really difficult. Typically, electricity is stored in an intermediate form. What I mean by that is you're not storing the electricity. You use electricity to do something, or like spin a generator or a motor, pump water uphill, and then you store the energy. And when you want that energy back, the water runs downhill, reverses the motor, becomes a generator, you get electricity back. But you didn't store electricity. You stored energy that can be regenerated to electricity. So there's lots of things like that. One of them is what we call a battery. We charge up a battery, which is an electrochemical machine, and we charge up ions. People remember from the high school chemistry, if you have a molecule and you electrically charge it, positive or negative, it's called an ion. And if you push ions around, push them to two sides of a piece of plastic, you have positive and negative ones stored separately. And then when you let them come together again, they release energy. That's the electricity. But you're not really storing electricity. You're storing an electrochemical charge. It's not electricity, but it remakes electricity. The reason I say all that is if you think about it, it's not just like a box that you stick stuff in, it's stored up. It's complicated, requires machinery at the electrochemical level or mechanical level. That means it's expensive and it's not very efficient. So batteries are really lousy ways to store energy, except when you want to store electricity, there's no second best. You have no choice. You can't have a smartphone without storing electricity to run it. So the batteries for that purpose, if they're really expensive, and they are, the cost per unit of energy stored, put differently, the electricity comes out of your smartphone battery is roughly speaking 50 to 100 times more expensive than the electricity that lights your light. But, you know, it's not very much electricity. Phones are incredibly efficient. And so you pay that premium. You're paying 50 times more for a unit of energy for the benefit of it being stored when you want it, where you need it, for something that's really remarkable, a smartphone that can communicate wirelessly. That idea got extended as batteries got better to, well, we could power our cars that way. This is, in the scientific terminology, another no-duh. Yes, many of the first cars were electrically powered using lead-acid batteries. You used lead-acid chemistry to electrochemically store charges that when they returned to the motor, they were returned as electricity and drive it again. But lead-acid batteries are extremely inexpensive and a very effective way to store small amounts of electricity. And they still beat lithium-ion batteries, which are in your phone, by a lot if you are looking at just price. But a lead-acid battery that could store as much electricity as your smartphone, the smartphone would weigh more than your laptop for the battery. So it wouldn't be very convenient to stick in your pocket or your purse. So lithium-ion chemistry was invented by an Exxon chemist, of all things, in the 70s in New Jersey. And two other chemists, one at University of Texas and another chemist at Sony, were instrumental in perfecting the sort of the formula, how to make it useful to manufacture this very difficult lithium chemistry. Lithium is one of the lightest elements on the periodic table, if you remember your high school physics. It's very light and very energetic. So it makes a really useful way to store electrochemical energy. Sony perfected that in the 90s. And that's when the first lithium batteries were on the market. Very expensive, small ones. They got better and better over the next 20 years. And right around 2010 or 12, Elon Musk was the first car company to say they're cheap enough and so much better than lead-acid batteries. I can now make a car that's useful and practical.
Well, he didn't engineer that car, to be clear. He was not the engineer.
That's correct. So Elon Musk was like Steve Jobs. So Steve Jobs did not invent the smartphone. He did not invent the computer chips to make it possible, the screens that made it possible. What Steve Jobs had was the imagination to, at the right moment in time in history, to have the sort of perspicacity, the aggressiveness, the capital, to put it all together in a way that was a useful product. Is exactly the same as Elon Musk and Tesla. There's no question about that. Also true for SpaceX. Everything he's put together there was invented before by others, but everything from his 3D printed machinery to make his rocket engines, all the rest, that's a form of innovation that gets ignored. It's the critical form of innovation that you can manufacture things. Hey, batteries are wonderful things. They're magical. But it's a really lousy way to store big quantities of energy, however.
Well, we're talking a little bit about lithium, but there are other rare earths and things that are often in batteries. Yeah. This is now a timely point of discussion. There's a lot of talk about trying to get things from Ukraine, where I assume there is extraction. There's also a concern. I saw a recent map of where Chinese ports have sprung up. And Africa is encircled.
Yeah.
And one of the concerns, obviously, from the left and the right, it makes no difference, is all of these very important minerals that would ultimately be used in batteries and defense systems, many of them are found in the ground in Africa. And it is a strategic concern when you see China encircling this. What's in batteries? Do we have that stuff? And even if we do, do we have the ability to process it for the kind of use that would be necessary for that kind of refined high-level battery? I mean, I've heard of germanium. I mean, where is that, for example? We don't have that, right?
The difference between most of history and today is that we use most of the elements on the periodic table to build things, from computers and lasers to weapons, tanks, airplanes, cars. And you're right. So it's not just lithium. It's also nickel and cobalt, manganese, the so-called rare earth elements, which are not rare. They have rare properties. This is praseodymium, dysprosium, neodymium, all these odd-named elements. They have unusual rare properties, electrical and magnetic properties, which make them useful for making light-emitting diodes and lasers and computer chips and communication systems. So the world needs these minerals. We call them critical minerals because it's a nomenclature was adopted a century ago for the minerals that are hard to get. Iron ore is easy to get to build steel from. It's very common. Neodymium is very rare. Copper itself is rather rare. If I told you gold is rare in rock, you'd say, well, yeah, I know that, right? So you look for high-grade ores. Well, high-grade ores, meaning that's one part in a million in the rock. It's very, very small concentrations of the metal in the rock. So who wants to mine it? Well, we've been mining rocks to get to minerals since before written history. Copper is one of the oldest mined metals, predates written history. You have to mine it. It's difficult. It's a dirty process. Once I tell you that only one part in a thousand is a metal, and that's a good one, you can do the arithmetic. I dig up 1,000 tons of rock to get to 1 ton of the copper. And then I have a ton of copper infused rock. It's not copper. This copper is hidden in the rock. You have to sort of think about how mining works, understand why the mining left America. You have to crush the rock and then dissolve it. You have to melt the rock with chemicals to get the copper out. Well, if you melt rock with chemicals, you don't have to be a chemist to know it's a lot of chemicals. They're probably pretty toxic because you're melting rock. So when you finish melting the rock and getting the chemicals out with other chemicals, you have a lot of waste chemicals that you have to treat and handle. So that's why it's a quote unquote dirty industry. So what has happened? We were one of the biggest mining industries, United States, mining domains in the world. We don't do as much mining anymore because we sort of chased it out of the country with environmental regulations and not in my backyard stuff. Whether you think that's good or bad, it just happened. What did the Chinese do 20 years ago? They said, well, the world's not going to stop using neodymium and germanium and graphite and cobalt. So they did two things. They mounted a massive effort to build the refineries, chemical processes I described, to refine these ores. And they mounted a massive effort not only to mine there, but to finance mines where it would be easy to do, like Africa, you know, compliant areas where money and corruption can talk, right? So China now, when it comes to the minerals that matter to us, the United States is 100% dependent on imports for about 22 metals. We're 50% dependent for another roughly 20. We import the metals into both refined and unrefined forms. The question you would ask is from whom do we import these things? Well, China has between 50 and 90% market share in a large suite of what we call energy minerals, the nickel, the copper, the cobalt, the lithium, either in mining it, but more importantly, in refining it. So they utterly dominate that. They have a larger market share by a factor of three. Their market share for energy minerals that are critical for not energy machines, but also for the military, is three times greater than the market share OPEC has in global oil markets. If you're a strategist, to use a Bushism, you would look at that and say, this might not be a good idea to have one country have triple the market share of OPEC in oil. So that's where we are. Is it easy to fix? Yes, in theory. I'll use an Obama line to quote another president. I have a pen. Government with a pen could change this because all the things that have driven mining and refining out of the United States have nothing to do with technology. We invented many of these technologies and we invented the industries in many cases, and we were dominant in them 20 years ago. We just passed laws with a pen that drove them away. Well, okay, you didn't want the mining here. You didn't get it. You got your wish. You move the environmental hazards to Africa and to Asia, but we didn't eliminate the need for the materials. If you want them back, you could use a pen, change the rules. The problem is, even if you did that tomorrow, even if we invoked another president, our current one, and said that our current president, who has stated this, he issued an executive order, an emergency order on minerals. And Biden issued a similar order, but not an emergency order, as did Bush 43, and as did a lot of presidents over history. What hasn't happened is we haven't expanded our mining and refining. You issue the order and nothing happens, because the order is feckless without a change in the rules. And we may not want to change the rules. And so far, we haven't exhibited the political appetite to change the rules. So we have to live with that. If we change the rules, these are massive industries. The mine costs $1 billion to $5 billion to open up. The average time from the idea of finding a high-grade ore to opening a mine, the average globally is 16 years. In the United States, it's far longer than that. So even if you were optimistic in the sense that the pen will be signed tomorrow, Congress will pass rules that will facilitate new mines and refineries. Even if you said it was all going to be accelerated, light speed acceleration would be a decade. So for the next decade, we have to live with the strategic and geopolitical reality of where we are, which has been generally ignored.
Let's talk about that for just a second. I mean, one of the conversations that we had was with Jeff Waxman about nuclear and how long it takes to bring anything on. Yeah. On nuclear. And, you know, of course, he's got this little like suitcase reactor that he can move back and forth. But so even if we reduced regulations, that's when you're talking about like best case scenario, 16 years.
Well, 10 years. You can build mines faster. Same for nuclear, by the way. The nuclear power plants are just like mines. They're big facilities. They take a long time to build. And the idea of small reactors, which everybody's all hot and sweaty about now, is really nice. I'm bullish on that. I spent a lot of time in the nuclear industry. They don't exist. You can't buy one. Until we have developed the supply chain and proved the ability to make them reliably and at scale, which will take a decade, when we've done that, and we will do that, we don't know how to build them yet. We have to build them and run them. This is no different than a new weapon system. You can imagine I want a new type of fighter aircraft or helicopter. From the inception to the deployment of it at scale, it's about a decade. That's because you have to prove the thing works, build a supply chain to manufacture it, make sure it's reliable, all those things. So nuclear plants and copper mines and rare earth mines are exactly the same, have exactly the same problem. Regulatory barriers, even when they're fixed, the other things will take time. When people
as well as chip fabs, right? I mean, it's all these things that we need. And we've all got our heads in the sand. As long as members of Congress are running for office every 2 years, and it's only what they can deliver in that length of time, I think it's pretty hard to sell. And it's also a function of American culture that we like a quick fix. The idea of working together to do something in 10 years in a safe and effective way, I think right now in this culture is certainly one of the biggest challenges we face. But I don't hear anybody selling that to the American people as a point of unification, right?
Well, there are people selling that story, and there's more people who believe what you said. First, I'm an immigrant. I've adopted the American culture. I came out of the Canadian culture, and I came here involuntarily because I like this culture. You know, the old adage is a can-do culture and all. It's still true in my experience. I think we're back moving into can-do mode. I think it is a bipartisan move. A lot of people are saying what you said. They may disagree on the edges about exactly how to do it, but the first step is to agree we should do it. I think we can move quickly, and I think we can make long-term plans. We have before. America's done this for a long time. But we are impatient. This is an impatient culture. That's what drives innovators to do what they do. They're impatient. Mines are difficult. You can see a picture on a Google map. They're big. Gee, it takes a while to build one. That means I have to plan in advance. We have to all agree about why we need them. And then you change the rules so you can make it possible to finance it and get it built. Those things, I think they're going to happen. I really do. I'm very optimistic now. I was pessimistic 5 or 10 years ago that it would take us 5 or 10 years to get to this agreement, and it did. These were known problems for the last 20 years that we were losing our manufacturing capacity in chip fabs. My first job was in a chip fab, and they're getting built now, and they're being built now for a variety of both structural, strategic, and economic and political reasons. And they don't take 10 years to build. The new big fabs are being built in 2 years. In Arizona and Texas, and some, I think, in Ohio, they'll get built quickly. And what will happen is, predictably, we'll overbuild them. This is what we always do. The capital markets, statist markets always mess up because people think they can guess the future perfectly, whatever it is. Capital markets always underbuild or overbuild. because you can't guess the future, right? But mostly what happens in capital markets, whether it's mines or chip fabs, is everybody gets enthusiastic and all want to compete to be the winner. And we get too many of them. This is good for consumers, by the way, because it causes prices of all the stuff to collapse. So we're on a cycle now to build too much of everything. I think that's great. This will be both chips and cars, by the way, and batteries. All the stuff's going to get overbuilt now. What we have to do is get through the underbuilt phase, which has economic risk. Prices go up while you're waiting. It has geopolitical risk because we have to find a way to get along with the Chinese. We're going to have to because they control all the metals we need. We can't easily replace for a while. Similarly, as you know, the Russians are just refiners of uranium in the sense of the enrichment process to make it ready for nuclear reactors. We voluntarily gave Russia that capacity during the sort of post-Cold War era, and we abandoned most of our capacity to do that. We can rebuild it, and we can rebuild it relatively quickly, but it'll take a number of years. It's not going to happen in months.
But I think it informs everything, you know, from conversations like peace treaties to whether or not tariffs are going to flame up the Chinese. And the other issue is it's very hard to get along with the Chinese when they can flood markets. It's nice to say that we should get along with them. We don't have any choice, but I think the point is they're not honest brokers in any of this space.
Well, sure. America has dealt with non-honest brokers for centuries. It doesn't mean that you have to be supine. Let them do what they want. You don't have to trust them. I worked as a young man in the Reagan White House, and he was the one who coined the line or recoined it, made it famous, trust but verify. When you're negotiating with a counterparty in geopolitics and in business, you always verify. You don't trust what they said, and you build things into your relationships or contracts that allow you to verify. People will cheat. Countries cheat. Companies cheat. But my point was that we don't have a choice is because we, the United States, put ourselves in this position. We have less manufacturing today, not because labor was cheaper overseas necessarily. It's somewhat cheaper. Is we made the cost of labor, not labor itself, the cost of doing the work here high. It's a regulatory cost.
Let's just go back. You're saying that they're going to overbuild. I find that interesting because so much of corporate America is driven by the need to show return on investment, their quarterly filings. You know, you have to get on those earnings calls. You know, I think it's very hard a lot of times to say, yeah, the pay dirt will be later, 10 years from now, 16 years from now. Yeah. I'd be interested to know how it is they're able to sell this as a long-term goal. Companies have in the past built things that took decades.
Well, we'll use as an example businesses like electric utilities or oil refiners because they build big infrastructure, or mining companies. All those companies in the public market, privately held companies can operate slightly differently. To your point, they don't have to do quarter to quarter, but they also have investors and owners too. Those are facilities that they build that take a long time, cost billions of dollars, and their primary benefits is they pay back over decades. They're building infrastructure that will last 30 years or 40 years. They do it all the time. So the idea that businesses, because they have quarterly metrics for reporting into the stock market, can't build long-lived assets with long-term planning associated with them is not true by virtue of what we're now still doing. The question is not whether we can do it. We're doing it. We're still doing it. It's whether we're doing enough of it to meet the demands that came. And that's when we get into this tug of war, certainly in energy domains, between the forecast for how much we need, how much electricity, how much oil or gas, how much lithium, which is always an informed guessing game, versus the impediments to building. And generally speaking, again, if businesses are enthusiastic about a growth metric, they will spend money and build. And they will be confident in taking the risk. They're trying to convince their investors, your stockholders. We know what we're talking about, whether it's an infrastructure for data centers or an infrastructure for power systems or highways. That's the sales pitch. And a lot of investors, by the way, are not investing quarter by quarter. Most investors, most of the investment managers that manage the 401ks, most long funds, quote unquote, they watch that stuff, but they're investing by the decade. If they think something's stupid, they'll sell it, but they're not investing for the short term. So even that notion that's in common circulation that we don't look long term, that's what your 401k is about. It's about believing that the stocks that's holding will be more valuable 5 or 10 years from now than they are today, the long term.
Well, I mean, I sincerely hope you're right. I mean, I do think that America's been acknowledged for its resilience going all the way back to Tocqueville, but I think It'll be interesting to see, because I think there's a lot of hopelessness right now that divisions can't be bridged.
Yes.
Yeah. I think part of that has to do with information silos, as we're kind of segueing to our conversation a little bit about data centers here. But the information silos created by the tweaking of the algorithm to sort of push everybody to extremes. I understand there's a bill kicking around right now to sunset Section 203 of the Communications Decency Act. And if that were to happen, I think you would see a big shift. People moving to the center rather overnight, I think, is what would happen. I find your observations on this score very interesting, obviously informed by many years of thinking about this stuff.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.